I'm Dwayne Schultes, and in this Vital Health podcast, I'm speaking to economist Doug Holtz-Eakin. He was formerly a professor of economics at Syracuse University and director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2005. He was also the chief economic policy advisor to Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Douglas is currently president of the American Action Forum in Washington, D.C., where we are today. Doug, it's always great to see you, sir.
Great to see you, Dwayne. Thanks for having me.
You, like me, were academia, and we left and did other things. What, do you miss academia? Do you miss teaching at Syracuse?
I don't, but I get my teaching fix. I did love teaching. I still do. There's an organization called the Washington Campus,
okay, yeah,
which brings to D.C. basically executive MBA programs from around the country, and they get 3 or 4 days in D.C., and that includes a lecture from me.
Oh, great.
And so, you know, I'm teaching probably 3-4 times a month, and, yeah, and that's a nice, you know, sort of refresher of that. I've always enjoyed that part of it. I didn't plan to leave academia. I actually left twice.
Okay.
I was an assistant professor at Columbia, and I was writing papers for obscure journals that no one ever reads, and trying to teach Columbia undergraduates who, in 1985, if you went to the Upper West Side of New York, you were very self-confident, and they were not interested in me at all. They were, you know. And so I had sort of a crisis of faith. I thought, I mean, like, this, does this profession make any sense? And in a crisis, you always go home. So I went back to Princeton, where I got my PhD.
Okay.
And then while I was there, John Taylor and Harvey Rosen, my two mentors, both went to the H.W. Bush administration. And I went with them. And I thought I'd never go back to academia. I'd go do something real, you know, come to D.C. What I learned during a year and a half there was I spent all of my time teaching economics to people. Like, they were strategists, or they were bureaucrats, or they were lawyers, or whatever. But I was like, you don't need to worry about that. That will take care of itself.
Right.
You know, this is how markets work. And it gave me a renewed faith in sort of teaching. And then I found out that people could and did say anything in the pursuit of their preferred policies. And the only check on it was the vast amount of research.
Right.
And you say, look, there have been 150 studies. That can't be the answer. We don't know exactly what the answer is, but it's not that.
Right.
And that was real. That wasn't like, okay, so this enterprise has some value. So I went back to Syracuse. Didn't want to raise my kids in New York. Did that until 2001, and I went to the W. Bush White House, George W. Bush. I thought I'd do 2 years there and go back to Syracuse. And at the end of that, I got offered the
CBO job
at CBO, and I did the CBO job. While I was doing the CBO job, we did some work on a Boeing Air tanker contract that was full of corruption for John McCain.
That was also going to go to Airbus as well. That was the I remember that.
Yeah, that was a big deal. And we did the financial work. And, it was Enron-esque in its design. It was super expensive. It made no sense.
Yeah.
And so the minute I was done at CBO, my cell phone rang. It's John McCain. He goes, look, you did a great job at CBO. I'm going to run for president. You want to help me out? And because I had never been involved in any campaign, even high school president, I said yes. I mean, if you knew something, you say, I don't know, John.
and that was a crazy campaign, too.
And it was an insane campaign. And at the end of that, I was in D.C., and I realized I had spent all my time at the White House, CBO, and on the campaign doing policy, research, education, options, advice, whatever it might be. But you did it on whatever was happening that day. Didn't have a choice saying, I don't do that. You know, you had to work on whatever the issue was. You had to do it in English to non-specialists.
Right.
And you had to, understand the politics. You had to make good policy, good politics. And I realized I really had enjoyed that way more than I enjoyed academia. And so I started the American Action Forum so that I could do that and not have a boss.
So you kind of get well, you're the boss.
I was tired of having a boss.
So in many ways, you get the best of both worlds because
yes,
you get to play around issues. That's how we've gotten to know each other. Inflation
and,
reduction.
And the research matters, and you get to contribute to it and read it and understand it. But I also get to teach. The classic think tank has deep subject matter experts. They sit in their office. They think deep thoughts. They imagine the world in 5 years. Periodically, the world collides with them, and they're relevant, and they go back in their, then they go back in their office. We chase the issues. So everyone here is young, except me. I'm old, but I have 20, 30-somethings who have maybe a master's degree or some Hill experience. They know who those deep subject matter experts are.
Right.
But their job is to weigh in on the issues going on in Congress and the agencies on behalf of our readers. And so it's a different formulation.
I'd like to touch on that moment when you joined the CBO back in 2003. Yeah. because that was a huge expansion of Medicare. That was the prescription drug benefit.
Yep.
I believe the technical name was it the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003.
Yes.
That just rolls off the tongue.
All the best titles come from Congress.
And I like the report very much, the one you authored in 2004.
Explaining how we did it.
Explaining how you did it and the analysis. And I've always thought it was a really rock solid analysis. And in fact, it's turned out to be pretty accurate. Your price tag at the end of the assessment was roughly $400
billion. $395.
Exactly. Unadjusted for inflation.
And the reason I can remember that is the CBO sits right next to Interstate 395.
Just a mere coincidence, I'm sure. Now, if we look at that in the context of, depending on which bundle we look at, which CPI we want to use. If we use the today's, it's a little light of $700 billion. If we look at it with the unadjusted 1982 basket, we're a trillion and plus. So $600-700 billion. So this is a huge program.
Yes.
It was a big program. Having that prescription drug benefit added in, has it been good for beneficiaries, economic productivity of the United States, taxpayer? Was it a good deal?
Yeah. The undisputable fact is that pharmaceuticals are part of modern medicine, and to not cover them in an insurance program didn't make any sense. So you had to get it in. You can quibble, and there are lots of places where you can quibble on how it got done the first time. I mean, the original insurance product, because it had to be $400 billion and not more, had an initial coverage area, and what had a deductible, then an initial coverage area, then this thing called the donut hole, where you had no coverage, then you had a catastrophic backstop. No one else would have designed an insurance product that way.
But you had to do it because of the budget limitations.
It couldn't be more than $400 billion, right. And we were deeply afraid of selection issues, so we wanted to bribe everyone in up front.
Allegedly.
Now, I can say that now, but you know, at CBO, you're not allowed to make suggestions.
Right.
Like, you just sort of, they give you a design, and then you give them back sort of where they are, and they kept saying, well, why isn't this working out? It's like, look, if you only offer this benefit in its current form, a standard insurance product, the only people who are going to buy this are going to be people who have enormous drug expenses.
Right.
You have a big selection problem. And it took a while for them to start thinking that way.
Yeah, because you end up with an overloaded risk pool.
Yeah, really do.
Yeah.
And we wanted to get a broad risk pool of seniors and cover them. So I think it has worked out real well. It would have been better, I think, to have paid for it in some serious way at the time. They didn't. But that, you know, wasn't my call.
If you read the bill, and I have numerous times, I always like to go back and get my head around it. The bill is quite explicit in several locations that the motivation for the bill was, and I'm going to quote here, to improve the acceleration of the adoption of innovation, unquote. And it also makes numerous references to promoting, again, quoting, the advance in medical technology that substantially improves the diagnosis or treatment of individuals. So at the bill's core, the Medicare Prescription Drug Benefit Bill of 2003-2004, the point was to sort of provide an incentive, a turbocharge, as it were, to get this new technology, personalized medicines, novel new treatments, orphan drugs, et cetera, that the U.S. was taking the lead on, to bring that forward. Do you think it's been successful?
Yeah, I think it's been enormously successful in sort of stimulating the R&D and the pipelines in the U.S. It's important to recognize that the authors of the bill thought there was a lot more to it than just the Part D program. There was also in it Medicare Advantage, which had been Medicare Plus Choice, but they sort of modernized it. And they viewed that as a more market-driven approach to the delivery of healthcare, which would automatically give us incentives for device development, pharmaceutical development, and superior delivery of healthcare. Now, that hasn't panned out as well as many people hope, but so it was the pairing that they thought was going to be so powerful. But for the record, the majority of seniors now enroll in Medicare Advantage.
Right.
So, you know, it's been successful. It's just not been as great on the delivery system as I think they hoped.
Well, I think one of the challenges we have with Medicare Advantage, and if we look at it rated to inflation, and this is where we get into the PBM problem, the buy-in, as it were, that you had to design into the bill, which I understand completely. But essentially, there's a hidden aftermarket tax that gets put in through the rebate. And what you've seen with Medicare Advantage, I think what it started at $30 and now it's mid 40s or 50. Meanwhile, everything else in healthcare has gone up, you know, 100, 200x.
I'm with you. I mean,
how we're doing that is we're increasing these rebates. And so we're creating these revenue streams to hold down the insurance pricing. Now, that said, I think that's a hidden tax that people don't see. And I think that's a big problem.
They're about to see it.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, I know we'll end up talking about that, but there's the part on the negotiation. Put that aside. It also dramatically redesigned the Part D benefit. So it gave seniors a catastrophic maximum for the first time. Used to have 5% forever.
Yeah.
But it also rearranged who pays. And the plans are now on the hook for a much bigger chunk of the cost of the benefit, including a big chunk of the catastrophic. They're going to have to put that into premiums. And so I think there's going to be just some real sticker shock in the next couple of years for MA beneficiaries when they realize what's happened here.
A lot of those revenues for the rebates as they exist now are going to be impacted because you as a company and you as an insurer are no longer going to be able to play the companies off each other to get the best deal. If you're dropping a drug that's coming out that's been on patent by 40, 50, 60%, essentially that's what was the rebate.
Right. Yeah.
And you start doing the math on this and you're getting, you know, $10 billion, you know, some of the big blockbuster drugs. I mean, you're looking at rebates of, you know, 60, 70%. That's what we had in the insulin class.
Yeah.
What's going to happen if insurance premiums go up, Doug?
There's nothing that politicians hate more than increases in premiums. I mean, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, subsidies, or Part D, you know, they hear from constituents when premiums go up. And so I don't know if they understand what they've passed. And when they start going up, people are going to hear about it. And then they're going to have to decide, are they going to throw more federal money in? It's not exactly something I think is a good idea. We're spending way too much to begin with. Or are they going to let the market sort of force a more vigorous competition, including the manufacturers, and see how that plays out?
But the problem is your hands are going to be tied because essentially you're putting in a price ceiling. And we know historically, in classical economics, a price ceiling, you get less supply.
The only cure for high prices is high prices. So it brings on supply.
Exactly.
Politicians don't like living through that. I don't know how this is going to play out exactly.
Right.
But I do think it's worth watching because I don't think people have fully wrapped their head around what is going on in the IRA. It is not just the negotiation about which I have all sorts of misgivings. It's this redesign, which makes some sense. It gives the plans super incentives to negotiate ferociously for lower drug prices. And that makes sense. But getting there is going to be rocky.
Well, not only that, there's a couple flaws in this design. And one of them is, again, when you read the law, and again, with Chevron deference that we have, the law is not necessarily what gets interpreted.
Oh, you have no idea.
Okay. So what's fascinating, if you look at this, there's no penalty for a PBM or an insurer to flip or switch to a new drug that comes on. And essentially this price ceiling, this rent cap, as it were, gets removed if there's another competitor that comes in the market.
Yep.
So essentially what we're doing is we're creating almost a secondary market, is actually a classical definition of rent-seeking behavior, essentially. So you're going to have this other actor, and you're going to have three parties then figuring out, if we bring in another actor, suddenly we're going to have 40, 50, 60% more market. But practically what this means is a branded generic or a branded biosimilar that's been used for decades and has all of the safety and efficacy and everything you want. And then there's a biosimilar or a generic coming in. Basically, all the plans could switch to this new drug. And then who's going to capture that 40 or 50% secondary market that's been created? I mean, this is a mess.
We're going to see.
The motivation is just too huge not to have that happen.
So I think we're starting to see some things happen which haven't happened before. And the most obvious example is CVS and Humira.
Yeah.
That's new. I don't know that I fully understand what's going on there, but they have decided that they are going to compensate their own PBM. Like, that's the advantage of the insurer owning the PBM. That's just an internal incentive problem. But they're not going to use rebates to do it. And they're going to compete on list price.
And they're going to own the entire value chain.
So, you know, there you go.
Right.
And so this is a different era. Things are changing dramatically.
But the question is, to put this in the international scope, if we look at where Europe was in 1980, Europe had 60% of the control of the market. They were producing and originating 60% of all novel therapeutics. Roll out the clock now to the study we just did and released on the general pharmaceutical legislation of the European Commission. We wanted to look at just drugs that were originated and then brought to market by a European company.
Couldn't find any.
Yeah, 17. We found 17, Doug.
17.
Out of 360 drugs.
Wow. So I have spent, the past 20 years telling members of Congress, policymakers, the medical innovation in the United States is not a God-given thing. Germany had it. They had it all. And they don't have it anymore because they didn't take care of it. And you guys have to take care of this. But they don't listen. I mean, they really don't. They think, oh, they're drug companies. What are they going to do? They're going to innovate drugs. That's what they do. I'm like,
Yeah, and they make money, too. And no one's going to sacrifice the amount of revenue that we're talking about.
And they don't innovate drugs without venture capital. And venture capitalists have other things to do with their money. That's the part they forget. Like, sure, I'm a drug company. I would like to make another drug. Can someone finance me? No.
And this is the problem that people are looking at. And certainly we should touch on the Congressional Budget Office's assessment and the Inflation Reduction Act.
Right.
What's been interesting about some of the analyses and some of the post-review rhetoric, I'll say, is that there's been several shots across the bow for some of us who are saying, hey, wait a minute, hold on, this isn't right. And they're saying, well, look, see, venture capital is just fine, but they're putting out late stage numbers. Like the data they showed 2 months ago showed Pfizer's acquisition of Seagen for $32 billion. It's like, no, wait a minute, that's a mature tree. Okay. Yep. I mean, this is the drug companies make drugs, but there are drugs to make and acquire and partner with. What they're missing is what's happening much further down, the people who are planting the trees, which is the venture capital.
The real risk capital.
The real risk capital. Yeah. The average 5 to 10 million of early stage investment at Angel. Yep. We're seeing, and I showed data in the meeting we had on the Hill, sponsored by WeWork for Health last month, we are seeing 50, 60% drops on early stage date. When you look at the early stage deal flow under a billion, so you're really looking at stuff that's not, mid-stage and acquisition, you're seeing huge drops.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's go somewhere else. The money's going to do that. And the Inflation Reduction Act has terrible, terrible incentives in it. And you're not going to migrate entirely out of drugs. You're going to migrate to drugs for pediatrics, or you're going to migrate to some other market that's not going to get touched, because this is now, a highly suspect place to do business. And you don't know how, given how opaque the process is, you have no idea what CMS is up to. You have no idea what these first 10 drugs are going to get in the way of maximum fair prices. I wouldn't put my money in there. It may come back a little bit if it turns out there's a sensible process that doesn't damage things too much, but I'm not confident of that at all.
Right.
There's a complicating factor here for your listeners who may not follow all the horrible things that we do in this country. The FTC, in conjunction with the Department of Justice, is on a full-scale jihad to stop all mergers and acquisitions for all practical purposes. And so they view a Pfizer buying a small drug company as a very bad thing. This is more market concentration. That's the supply chain of drugs. That's how that works. They're killing it. I mean, they are stopping it. And they don't understand what they're doing to biopharma, which has relied on this mechanism as the way to get the money out back to the original investors. And so the big drops reflect not just the Inflation Reduction Act, but this environment.
What's really interesting, Doug, if you look at, which we have, 360 drugs by origination, type 1, top line FDA approvals, yes, you do see the big companies teaming up with the small companies, sometimes acquiring them. But what's fascinating is you also see the big companies passing down intellectual property to small companies to say, okay, we originated this, but we're moving it down. And it's about 30% of all intellectual property that's invented by big firms.
I didn't know that.
Yes. It shocked us when we found this. And we started talking to some of our clients saying, we're seeing 30% drop down. It's like, oh yeah, if it's a small orphan or a small target that's not really scalable, it doesn't make sense for us to do it.
I see.
And so what I think these people don't understand, these people who are regulating this business, is there's adjustments that are made to who develops the stuff based on the scalability and the need for volume. Right. It's a volume play. There's a reason why you have a local bank in a local city to help the ma and pa, but there's a reason why you have, you know, a huge investment.
JP Morgan.
Yes, exactly. A huge investment bank to deal with those sort of mergers and acquisitions. There's a scale problem here. And if you look at it from the revenue generated by the asset, I mean, you just see that big pharma generates huge revenues, but they're going into 25 countries in Europe at one shot. They're coming in and negotiating with all 50 U.S. states at one shot. Now, a small biotech can't do it. But they will target an orphan community with, you know, 60 patients in France, you know, because they can do that and they can scale to that. Why do we have such a misunderstanding of the dynamics of the sector? How has this happened?
That's a really good question that I can't fully answer. There is this tendency in policymaking in general, but in health policy especially, to play the politics on people's heartstrings.
Right.
This is a moral issue. Everyone should have access to this thing. So, God forbid you make a profit. And, you know, you're taking advantage of people if you make money on it. And so there's this sort of steady characterization of that type. And then there's the notion that somehow, because you see the big companies, that they're the whole game and they're missing everything underneath them. If you take the time and go talk to the professional staffs on the communities and jurisdictions, they understand, but their members often get pulled into the politics and vote for things that don't make a lot of sense because they are politically very popular.
Well, I mean, look at HR3, the bill that didn't come, but went to committee, and it was
a terrible bill.
One bill in committee. Scott Peters basically flipped his vote in committee. But, you know, Scott Peters is from San Diego, but Nancy Pelosi introduced the bill. She's from San Francisco. I mean, California and Massachusetts dominate global biopharma.
Right.
And yet you had California and Massachusetts politicians overwhelmingly supporting, cutting off their nose despite their face, some would say.
Yeah.
Is it just political expedience?
Yes.
Do they?
Yes.
Yes.
In the end, yes.
But this is we're talking trillion-dollar industries.
So this is crazy. I mean, you know, this is a lot of jobs.
Yes.
This is a lot of resources. I mean, I'm not here to defend this. I don't like it a bit. I think we've really mistreated the industry, and we're going to pay for it at some level. I mean, it's not smart.
If we look at the analysis that the CBO published specifically, and this is where you and I have gotten to know each other, we've been talking about this on several panels here on the Hill. What was intriguing to me, and you also brought this up, as well as Peter Kulchinski, there was a lack of understanding in the analysis. They did the analysis in what's called the aggregate. They did it at a sort of an average firm.
Yep.
Whereas we think, and what Peter is saying with his portfolio, he says, look, if I invest in small molecules now, oncology products, cancer drugs, that target an overwhelmingly Medicare population, I'm going to lose 40 to 50% of my profit. Yet the CBO didn't do an analysis at the indication level. And I think when you and I were discussing that,
indications are the key.
And when I brought that up, I mean, there was audible gasps among several congressmen in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Because the implications suddenly came quite to the front at that point.
So in the end, what matters is how beneficiaries are impacted. And indications tell you how many beneficiaries you're going to impact, not drugs.
Right.
Drugs is the wrong index. And so the focus was on the wrong thing. And I think that's become clear. And indications are going to be deeply affected by the IRA because the timing incentives are really different now.
Oh, yeah.
You used to just, you know, go to market with the first indication and then do an aftermarkets and getting more and off you go. You get to Humira and God knows, 17, I think, maybe more. The incentive will be to keep it off the market until you have all the indications.
Yeah.
Then get it on the market, get your money for 9 years, and, you know, see how you do. Well, so we will defer access to novel therapies. It doesn't make any sense.
At the point where they're most needed, or at least where there's the highest need, which is in late stage, you know, non-treatable cancers, people who are metastatic and dying.
Right.
Oh, by the way, sorry, you know, have a penicillin and an aspirin, you know?
Yeah. So it's, you know, not been thought through, I think. It just, the legislation was rushed and it was very political. Like, we, you know, we're going to do this because we can, and we're going to show them we can take some of their money. But this really was just political retribution to Republicans for putting in the non-negotiation provision originally. I mean, you know, that's all that was. And pharma.
getting to that, essentially what we're putting in now is a European-style price control, essentially.
Yes. No, not essentially.
It is.
It's in statute what the maximum fair price starts out as.
Yeah.
So that's a price control, and then you negotiate down from there.
Are you comfortable with the idea of us assuming the sort of European style?
No.
No.
Not at all. As background, so I was at CBO, we bill got passed, we did the analysis on it, and the minute it's passed, the sort of non-negotiation clause becomes a political football, and I get the first of the letters, what would happen if you got rid of this clause? And we wrote back and said it would have essentially no material impact on the cost of the drugs or the bill as it was passed, because really negotiating, not what's in the RA, but really having a negotiation between the Secretary of HHS and a pharma company didn't bring anything additional to the market. I mean, what can the Secretary do? They don't have a formulary. And if they tried to develop a formulary, they'd be telling some seniors what they could and could not get at the national level. That's never going to happen. So they didn't have any negotiating power. If you looked at a prescription drug plan, they had a formulary, they had a couple million beneficiaries, they had what was necessary to try to cut a deal for a better price on the drug. And the Secretary didn't bring anything to that. So if it was my world to run in, I would say to the next Congress, let's get rid of the tax, the excise tax for people who fail to negotiate in good faith. That's in that's a
90-95% tax.
That's the tax as a fraction of the price, including the tax. If you look at the tax as a fraction of the price net of tax, 1,900%.
Jeez.
So
yeah, of course.
Yeah. You make a dollar, you hand 17 to the Treasury. It's meant to put you out of business, period. So get rid of that. Then get rid of the statutory language that says this is going to be at 45-70% of the ASP, whatever. So get that out.
Depending on the
timing.
That's
the pure price. That's a pure pricing thing. But don't take out the fact that they get to select 10 drugs and negotiate. And let's see how they do.
Where do you think it ends up?
I think we would end up back where we are.
I agree.
I really do.
I completely agree.
And you would get rid of the political baggage of having told the Secretary they can't negotiate. Let them. I mean, it's a terrible job. Maybe they want to spend their time talking to drug companies.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't.
Can you imagine trying to negotiate with a fleet of pharma lawyers?
No.
Oh, my God. My idea of hell. It's bad enough to do contracts with them.
No, I mean, honest to God, no, it's not for me. That's for sure.
Getting back to your analysis that you published on the initial version of the prescription drug benefit, when you go back and read it, and again, I commend you because it seems like what I would consider a proper, it's a very sober economic, straight up, boom, here's what it is, here's the math, here's the numbers, it's very transparent. I love that document, and I it was nice to go back and reread it, Doug.
Well, I'm really pleased to hear that because we didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
But I thought the world deserved an explanation for how we came up with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so that it was meant to fill that need.
Are you surprised that, and I'm going to be careful here, but are you somewhat surprised that it seems like the later version that we've just had now for the Inflation Reduction Act does not seem as transparent? It does not seem...
I am surprised.
It is a bit opaque, and it does seem... particularly the response to those of us who have been saying, well, wait a minute, that's not right, it seems more politicized.
It is. The MMA was politicized. I mean, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. That was a Bush initiative. It was a very political environment. But this is way worse. No question about it. The legislation is not as transparent. The execution of these negotiations is absolutely in the dark. We have no idea what's going on. It was done on a party line vote using reconciliation. It was very politicized.
And the analysis as well just didn't seem to take on board the reality of how the market works.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to reflect the market reality of how a venture capitalist is deciding to allocate resources.
I think it was done too quickly. I was there for the completion of the Medicare Modernization Act, but they had been working on drug benefits for seniors for about 4 years. And the initial one, there was something called the initial helping hand. And that was a $50 billion program that the administration was proposed when he first showed up in 2001. And, Mark McClellan was at the Council of Economic Advisors when I was. And, he was running around trying to get this administration initiative through. He kept asking for more money. We kept, you know, sort of saying, Mark, what are you up to? He got up to $400 billion. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And but because that had been going on for a number of years, the CBO got a chance to try out how some logic on how it would work and run it by people. And, you know, the CBO does a very good job of staying in touch with the research community, sending their experts to conferences so they can hear what's going on and talk about what's going on. And there was some very critical feedback early on, and that was taken to heart.
Do you think that happened this time?
I think they went too quick and they didn't get a chance to do that.
It was shocking when the 1% number came out.
Yes.
We were running traditionally somewhere between 20 and 30%. Biotech puts 40% of every dollar they get, goes 40% of it goes straight into R&D. I mean, yeah, that's an enormous cash burn. The joke we like to tell at our firm, a boat is a hole in the water that you throw money, and a biotech company is a hole in the backyard you throw boats. You know, it's just, it's a cash intensive sector. And the idea when we met with CBO, we were invited in to talk to him in September, and we said, you can't cut this much revenue. Yes, your NPVs have written down. Yes, this money doesn't matter from an investor standpoint, but the fact is, this is the most profitable cash that is being used to invest, and this is being used to fund R&D. We know that a quarter to 30% of this is plowed right back in to partnerships, acquisitions, right, deals, development, yeah, and you're cutting the most important cash flow. And the answer was, well, there'll be a new model. And what's the new model? Well, VCs will take it. Okay, and who makes the VCs whole? And there was silence.
Right.
You know? And that's what concerns me. It's just, there's been, I don't want to say magic thinking, but there's just been this,
yeah,
loss of how the system actually works. There's a real lack of understanding there.
I insisted that the staff be able to explain to me why we were getting what we were getting.
Right.
And there were times they couldn't. I said, well, you better go back and either this is wrong or you don't understand how it's working, because we were trying to make sure that we understood what we got, because we were starting from a point where there was not in nature an insurance product for the financial cost of outpatient prescription drugs for seniors.
Right.
It did not exist. So we were going to have to imagine that market and the markets that supported it, the negotiations with manufacturers, the development of drugs, entry of generics. That's the one thing we misjudged. We really got, our numbers were too high. There's a lot more generic entry in the end than we anticipated.
Yeah.
That's life. But I needed to be convinced we thought through all the market mechanisms. And they clearly have not gotten all the market mechanisms.
But the fact is, the bill's 20 years old.
Yeah.
It's normal that you'd need to tweak a little bit here and there.
No question.
And I think the one thing that's become apparent, it's the rebate side. It's that huge revenue stream that gets thrown back. Yeah. And the opacity around the premium part of this is really tough.
So I think another example of a pretty unhelpful debate is the PBM discussion on Capitol Hill. So let's just, there's, I think, little appreciation of the fact that there's going to be somebody who manages the drug spend. If you're an insurance company, that has to happen. Now, it might be a division, or you might want to do an arm's length contract with someone to manage it for you. That's what a PBM starts out as.
Right.
But someone's going to be managing it. So the idea of the existence of a PBM is not itself shocking, although people now look at it and say, well, this is just corruption. They exist only... No, there's a function that they're, yeah, serving there. Now, what's extremely odd is that they get paid by everybody.
They get a slice from every value part, every part of the value chain. They take a slice. Yeah.
So it's like, wait a minute. Like, I'm an insurer. Why can't I write an incentive contract? You hit these metrics, I pay you more, and you control my drug spend. Why is it that you get to get paid by the drug manufacturers? I don't understand. Like, talk to me about this.
Well, cynically, they've bought everybody in the value chain too.
No,
they vertically integrated.
What
a
they
lot.
Will say is, there was this consent decree that came out of a lawsuit years and years and years ago that said this is the only way you can do business. Now, I don't believe that for a second.
Right.
But anyway, they exist in this value chain. They're getting a piece from everybody, as you said. And the idea that you can just somehow put in some regulations on them and be sure that you're getting something right with the consumer, they have no contracts with the ultimate consumers. They are not beholden to them in any way. So they need to think about the whole chain. And then if they want to do something, that's fine. I have no problem with it. But this, let's take a rifle shot and fix the problems. I don't think so.
It's a situation where everyone has the wrong idea of who the end consumer is.
Right.
I think fundamentally this comes from the fact that our political class says, well, it's the person buying the drug is the consumer. When in fact, it's actually the person paying the premium is the consumer, for better, for worse.
Yep.
And there's absolutely no there's no transparency on that transaction. It's a hidden, it's a dark market. So do we start then by theoretically saying, okay, let's open that up and make it more transparent? I mean, Trump had that as an executive order that got rescinded.
Right.
Everyone who's tried to step on that, it's a, you know, they think they're stepping on a pot of gold and it ends up being a landmine, it seems.
The Trump executive order fell apart because it was deemed to raise premiums. And
which may have to happen. If you cut rebates, premiums will, A plus B plus C needs to equal D.
But, you know? But it's also true that if you're a manufacturer and you're selling me a drug for $100 and then give me a $20 premium, the next year when they force us to not get, have the rebate,
that $20 has to come from somewhere.
We're going to negotiate to 80 and be done.
Yes.
Like, you know, this is a repeated game. It's not complicated.
Yeah.
So I think the analysis was all wrong. I do.
How do we fix it?
I would fix it by forcing the premiums through.
But that's going to require, in this political class,
very hard.
The representative from Twitter. I mean,
it's true.
I agree with you. I mean, I've talked to, in this building, John Michael O'Brien from the National Pharmaceutical Council. Maybe premiums have to go up. There is a general belief it's possible they will have to go up.
Well, as I said earlier, they're going to go up because of some of the other design features, and maybe the world won't end and they'll learn a lesson from that. Weirdly, this is congressional thinking. Premiums can't go up. Name the insurance product. Doesn't matter what it is. Flood insurance, health insurance, drug insurance. Premiums can't go up. Okay. We're not going to raise premiums. How do we do that? Well, let's just cover less stuff. Premiums won't go up. And that's what they do. So they steadily create worse insurance and then say, but premiums haven't gone up. Yeah, but you're not covering anything.
And this is what's in, yeah. But what you're describing now is my life in Belgium. This is Europe.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's access. You end up with access restrictions because, again, it's like putting in a rent control. You get less property. Yeah. It's inevitable.
It's inevitable.
The market will equalize at whatever you put it at, unfortunately.
I'm the last person who, you know, wants to wish high prices on people. But if you want a quality product, sometimes you got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And politicians want to have it both ways. They want a high quality product. They don't want it to cost anything.
Or they want someone else to pay for it out of their district.
That would be even better. Yes, I would agree.
So we've talked a little bit about the fact that these 10 drugs now, the first 10 that are going to be negotiated are now public. Were you surprised, given all the hype and hoopla, controversy and all the letters being written around cost of cancer drugs, et cetera, that suddenly it wasn't cancer drugs, it was mostly cardiovascular drugs that ended up on the list? Did that surprise you at all?
Yeah. I why we went after blood thinners? I mean, they, you know, Eliquis and, you know, Xarelto, those, if you look at those are not expensive drugs. This is not the poster child for what upsets people. There are a lot of people on them. There's a lot of Part D spend because there are a lot of people on them, but they're relatively modestly priced drugs, and they're in the negotiation. That seemed to me not the intent of what they started out to do. So, I was very surprised. There's also, remember, that this administration likes to trap themselves. He launched a cancer moonshot and then sought to destroy cancer innovation. I mean, so I think they were trying to hide a little bit.
When we ran our list on this, when we did our analysis, we went on a calendar year, so January to December. One could argue you could have gone September to October, sort of following the Medicare budget, the CMS budget. They went June to May. And what's interesting...
Oh, I hadn't focused on that.
Oh, we did.
Okay.
And what's interesting, when you run June to May, you captured that entire Omicron cycle.
Oh.
And you mentioned the numbers. And what was fascinating, when we looked at our cohort and we started looking at the amount of beneficiaries that we calculated, it's like, you know, our you know, we got a lot of cancer drugs. We got 4 or 5 cancer drugs in our initial analysis. And this is, anyone wants to see this, we've given a big description of this on our website and even got written up in BioCentury. We had an interview about it. What was fascinating was when you ran it from June to May, you ended up getting twice the number of beneficiaries than our cohort. So you go from 4 million people to 8 million people, roughly. Wow. Yeah. And again, not to be conspiratorial here, but this is Washington, D.C., and we're moving into an election year. And politicians have been going on stage at union rallies saying, we got big pharma. And,
yeah.
It is intriguing in a state like, say, Arizona, where you've had a 60% increase in retirees over the last 4 years since the last election, where they put the baseline to see if they could maximize beneficiaries. That's yeah. just, that does seem like a potential to our firm.
I wouldn't rule that out. From the beginning, from the beginning of the Part D program, there have been these conspiracy theories. And, you know, I can remember being told that I was just simply working at the personal direction of Karl Rove as we tried to buy
America, was he on your speed dial?
Buy America's seniors stuff for Bush in 2004. I mean, that's how a lot of people viewed the Part D. I'm like, that's not how this works. But you know, you can keep your conspiracy theory.
So Hatch-Waxman, that's the bill that gave us the whole idea of the generics, yeah. and that was sort of analogous and parallel to Bayh-Dole and some of the real
yep.
great legislation, really high-quality legislation that really turbocharged the American economy.
And those were tributes to great leaders. Orrin Hatch was a tremendous leader. So was Bob Dole. I mean, they were all bipartisan. They took, Hatch-Waxman. Those are some really unlikely bedfellows, but they really got it done, did it carefully, took time, got their colleagues up to speed on it, passed it. That was a better process than even the MMA, quite frankly, and certainly better than the IRA process, the sort of care of crafting the legislation. Too much gets now left to, look at all the things they left to CMS.
Yeah.
Right? So we're not going to write down what we want. They wrote down what they wanted. Those pieces of legislation, this is how it works.
What's really intriguing in the IRA legislation when you read it is when you get this exemption for having a generic competitor, the bill says, and I'm quoting, at the point of applicability. That's the language. Okay, fine. When we modeled it, we thought, well, that's when the price goes to the market. That's when the maximum fair price is put in. But CMS interpreted it under their Chevron deference to be, no, that needs to be in 2 years before when we start the negotiation. Now, if you look at biologics, they're going to be negotiated at year 11. You have 12 years of data protection. I mean, so there's no way, right. I mean, unless you're willing to open up.
No one's going to get it. It's an empty exemption.
Yes, precisely. Yes. So you're going to have at least a minimum of 1 year where you're going to be maximum fair priced, whether you want to or not. Have we Mickey Mouse ballooned with duct tape a solution to Hatch-Waxman or a fix to Hatch-Waxman, what people didn't like around IRA? Have we just basically not solved the real problem?
I think we've not. Yeah, this is not a solution to a real problem. This is a solution to a political problem, which is we want to say that we, for the first time, are negotiating drugs in Medicare. Republicans are wrong. We want to get pharma because they're evil. And we want to make things cheaper for the seniors and get a big thank you. The trouble is the cheaper for seniors part may not work out so well because their premiums are going to go up. They're in some bizarre cases, like you think of, go back to the anticoagulants, the Xarelto and
Eliquis.
They give you the maximum fair price. They stop using rebates to get preferred placement on formularies. Now, something that used to have zero copay comes with a copay.
Yeah.
The seniors are going to be like, hey, what happened here? This used to be free to me. Now I got to pay for it. What is so great about this bill? So I think they ought to be careful about spiking the football too quickly. There are a lot of landmines in there.
Yeah, exactly. Or your branded drug that you like suddenly goes generic. But, now the competitor comes in because they've negotiated with the PBMs directly. And that's going to be 3X, 4X the price. The branded generic gets price controlled. But there's going to be a 1 year gap. And then this other branded comes in because they're paying a higher rebate. It gets on the other preferred tier.
Yep.
Now you can't get the drug you wanted. I mean, there's so many perverse incentives in
there
this
are,
bill.
There are a lot. And I have little doubt that the CMS guys did the arithmetic on the biosimilars pretty carefully, came up with how they interpret point of applicability. That's the lawsuit. I mean, you know that. And given the temperament of the Supreme Court recently, they could very well say That's an overreach. Forget the Chevron deference. That was not the intent of Congress. You're done. And they'll throw the rule out for sure, but they may throw out
more parts of the bill.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly the 90-95% tax. Yeah. I mean, that could violate the taking clause. We'll have to see.
So I was my fields in graduate school were public finance and monetary theory, and so tax policies near and dear to my heart. I'm a former editor of the National Tax Journal. Great read.
Sexy bathroom reading.
Yeah, the best. But, I mean, it just offends me that anyone thinks that that's an appropriate use of the taxing powers of the federal government. Like, it's that you're just taking. They're putting them out of business. That's the point of that. And I think it should be thrown out.
If you look at neurology, you know, we've been asked to say, do you see some movement out of the U.S. in some classes where we see a lot of failure? Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen a tenfold increase in some classes of neurological research in China recently.
Really?
Okay. 10x. Now, again, it's early days and no drugs are coming out yet, but you're seeing huge, I mean, jumps, big, gigantic jumps in some of the Chinese clinical research databases where clinical trials are registered. It's a bit scary. Do you see an acceleration if we keep doing this here? I mean,
it'll go somewhere. It'll go somewhere. This is not my area of expertise, but I my understanding was Ukraine was a tremendous location for clinical trials in that there were like a 1,500 clinical trials underway when Russia invaded. Clinical trials have to be held somewhere.
Yeah.
So I don't know where I don't know that industry. I don't know where it's migrating, but it's going to have to, something's going to have to happen.
It's fascinating to me that we're creating a similar parallel disincentive to the U.S. market that the Europeans did when they, at the turn of the century in 2000.
We learned nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I think it's the lack of respect by this administration in particular for intellectual property protection is, to me, frightening. You know, it started with the TRIPS waivers for the
oh, yes.
COVID vaccines.
Absolutely.
Didn't think we'd ever see a U.S. government do that. This IRA is just an assault on intellectual property protection, no question about it. And the
marching rights
is a further assault. And rumor has it, just rumor, I don't actually know any facts, that they're going to finalize that guidance in the near future, and we'll see what it actually holds. But we actually did something close to march in rights a long time ago in contracts with the universities, and they just dried up completely.
Yeah, this was with the CRADA grants and the intramural grants.
Yeah.
Congress, when that bill was put in 1995,
I believe. That's when it was, yeah. I knew it was back there.
Yeah. In 1996, they were... Director Varmus of the NIH removed the maximum fair pricing clauses that were put into CRADA grants, and they went up 8x.
So we've done this before, and we'll have to learn the lesson again, I guess.
What's scary with march-in rights is...
It's broader than just health.
Yes.
That's what's scary to me.
Yes.
Everybody working in the AI field should be terrified.
Google was a DARPA grant.
Yeah, they should all be terrified.
Yes, we did a deep dive on all the patents for all 364 approvals that we have in our database. It's intriguing because over the last 10 years, most of the applications have been on one drug, Xtandi, which is a late-stage metastatic oncology product for prostate cancer that my dad is being kept alive on right now, so I do take this quite personally. When we looked at thousands of patents, hundreds of drugs, and we analyzed the origination of all of the patents, we found that the only drug where all of the mechanism of action and composition of matter patents came from the government, that you could actually trace to the government, was Xtandi. This is the only one you can go after, folks. So this is why you've been going after it. So now they're actually just...
Oh, no, it says they're going to lower drug prices.
Yeah, exactly. But right. Now they're saying, well, we're just going to start using 1498 executive power. We're just going to start taking stuff and declaring an emergency. Have you ever thought in your life in the United States we'd be threatening private property in a private market? It seems bizarre to me.
It is bizarre, and I never thought we'd see this. I mean, just really didn't. There's been a complete loss of faith on the left side of the aisle in private enterprise and market mechanisms. They really believe that the government makes the economy grow. If you listen to the administration, they talk about how smart public investment is how things get done. Not last time I checked, they don't view it as private property. They don't have the same firm line. They're very comfortable prying open private contracts.
Yeah.
Like, you got to tell us what's in there. Why? That's a private contract between two individuals. So you leave it alone. That's a line that I was taught you don't cross. Right? You respect that. And if there's a genuine national security issue or genuine emergency, then you might contemplate it. But we kept the public health emergency in place so that he could use executive powers as much as he wanted.
You're an older hand in this town than I am. How much of this, nothing about your age, just in your experience, Doug, of course.
Both.
How much of this is just related to the vast expansion of federal liquidity, you know, the 0% discount window, creeping through all aspects and crowding out private sector? If you look at Google and you look at a lot of the IT companies, a lot of this is coming through government contracts.
Yeah.
A lot. Have we just expanded the federal purse too much?
Yes. Yeah,
I mean, we're putting in, what, $1 trillion in debt every 6 months now or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's we simultaneously just expanded the scope of the government enormously, and then at zero interest rates, it was costless to keep going.
Right.
Now we're in a different place. It costs real money now, and interest is exceeding the size of the Pentagon.
Yeah.
These interest costs are making it real. I think that'll put a check on some of this stuff. But for 10 years, it's been...
Game on.
Game on. Let's get bigger. And truthfully, the political development that I didn't anticipate is the right wing of the conservative movement, the MAGA version, and the left wing progressives, the very left, are comparably statist in their attitudes.
Oh, they want to exert state power.
Yes, they do. And it's not that they can't. They want to.
Yes.
So they do.
Which is very interesting because it's sort of like in a lot of European governments, France, where you have a lot of centralized control over the government. Mm-hmm. In the UK, where so much of the governmental decision emanates from London, there isn't a lot of decision that's allowed to percolate out to the various cities and towns. It's bizarre to me that we've gotten here. How does this self-correct? As the interest rates go up, it's just going to have to fix itself?
And I think as the outcomes are not what were promised in the political disappointment becomes real, then there'll be a, well, didn't we used to do it some other way and it worked pretty well?
Or you're going to, what you see increasingly is they just double down because they only have one switch and they just turn it more.
That will be the first thing they'll do. But since it won't work, ultimately, they'll pay a price for it. And one of the things that I think is worth noting is that the current generations of voters basically can't get anything new out of the federal government because it's all the money's been spoken for many times over.
Yeah.
By these past efforts. That's a recipe for dissatisfaction. I'm paying taxes and I'm voting for things and you can't give me one thing I want?
Yeah.
What's up?
The new drugs are going to come in right around the election time. These new prices, these maximum fare prices are going to start to be announced. Then we're going to see the impact on insurance. How does this correct? Where do you think this goes?
So all they'll have for the election is announcements. And so that's the rosy scenario. And they'll see what they can ride. Then they will run into the fact that only about 10% of seniors really get any benefit out of a lot of the things they're talking about, that insulins and free vaccines and stuff like that. The other 90% will be like, okay. And they're going to see their premiums go up dramatically. And they're going to see, I think the standalone Part D plans are going to go away.
Yeah.
They don't have the tools to manage the kind of requirements they have to finance the benefits. So a lot of people who have for 6 years, just every year picked the same plan, their drug was on the thing, they did it, the world's going to suddenly be complicated again.
Yeah.
And it's going to be expensive. And they're going to be unhappy. And that unhappiness will translate into a bipartisan agreement to do something. Republicans want to do something. Democrats are going to buy in because they're on defense now. We'll fix the things that were wrong. It was a good idea, but we'll fix the things that are wrong. So the bill will get opened up. And the question then becomes, who's got control of the chambers and presidency, and where does it go?
Sanity returns?
You would hope. And, you know, as I said, I don't think you ever repeal the Inflation Reduction Act. I think that's a trap that the Democrats laid very well for Republicans. If you repeal it, you get rid of the catastrophic maximum.
Yeah.
And you're the person who wants old people to pay millions of dollars for drugs. That's a political loser. So you have to amend it, which means you have to think about what you want much more carefully than just get rid of it. That's the right thing to have happen.
Douglas Holtz-Eakin, president of the American Action Forum. Doug, it's really been great getting to know
Thanks for having me.
And I hope we can continue to have these conversations as we go forward.
Well, we appreciate your contributions to the research. Understanding things is valuable in my view, so thank you.
Thank you, Doug. The executive producer of the Vital Health Podcast is Dwayne Schultes. Our editor is Mark Brodeen. Our project manager is Gwen O'Loughlin. The Vital Health Podcast is a production of Vital Transformation, LLC, copyright 2024.